Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Ready for this unrehearsed conference are four of America's top reporters. Their guest, Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., former ambassador to the United Nations. Here is Meet the Press.
The presidential campaign shares public attention this week with the opening of the General Assembly of the United Nations. Our guest today, Mr. Henry Cabot Lodge, has an association with both of these news stories. He served as ambassador to the UN for 7.5 years before resigning to campaign for the vice presidency. His long experience in dealing with world problems is being heavily accented by Republican campaigners. Mr. Lodge served for 13 years as a senator from Massachusetts, and he managed the Eisenhower nomination campaign of 1952. We'll start the questions today with Mr. Spivak.
Ambassador Lodge, you said this in a recent speech, and I quote, "Peace in certain specific ways appears to be a little closer." Now, most of us who look at the tense world today and the rising tensions feel that we're further away from peace rather than close to it. What do you base your optimistic statement on?
I didn't say that peace was generally closer. I said that in that speech, I said that this was a very dangerous world and full of mysterious dangers that we couldn't see as well as those that we could. But I don't think it's a picture of unrelieved gloom. I think the muscle, the strength that the United Nations has acquired, largely with American support, is a factor that didn't exist as strongly as it does now. And I believe that that is a little bit of something on the bright side.
Well, Ambassador Lodge, you said that in certain specific ways...
Yes.
It appears, peace appears to be a little closer.
Yes.
Can you give us some idea of what you mean, by what ways it is we seem to be on the losing defensive in Cuba, in
Congo?
Oh,
I don't agree at all. No, I don't agree with that at all. That's the common generality, if I may say so, and I don't think the facts bear it out. If it hadn't been for the United Nations and for the action which was taken in the United Nations concerning the Congo, we might very well have had a war there now. The United Nations came in with this force and has so far successfully prevented the Congo from becoming a bone of contention between the major powers. And I was glad to see former Governor Stevenson, a man whom I respect and esteem, say in the New York Times Magazine today that the United States has much to be proud of. I think those were his words in connection with the work of the United Nations. And Senator Mansfield, who's a Democrat from Montana, has spoken well of the work that Secretary Herder and I have done in the United Nations on this African question. Now, that's the most recent question, but of course there are other illustrations. For example, in 1958, the validation by the United Nations of the action that we took in Lebanon, that had a very stabilizing effect. I think the creation of the United Nations Emergency Force and the resolution, the two-thirds voted resolution stationing the emergency force in the Gaza Strip, converted that area from something that had been explosive and dangerous into an area that is quiet. Now, those are all tangible accomplishments, and they can't be overlooked just by a sweeping generality.
Well, Mr. Ambassador...
I don't say you're making a sweeping generality, but it has been done.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, do you think that we today, the United States, is stronger in the minds of the world than we were, for example, when you first came to the UN?
I think our prestige is higher than that of any other country. And there's no place on earth where you can measure prestige as well as you can in the United Nations, because any member, large or small, can get a meeting of the Security Council or a meeting of the General Assembly, can get a resolution passed criticizing the United States if he can get the votes. And none of them have ever done it. And what is more, the United States has never been defeated. And what is more, even on ticklish questions like the Cuban action against us a few months ago and the RB-47 case, Even the Afro-Asian members of the Security Council, who are uncommitted, so-called neutral countries, voted with the United States. Now, Mr. Spivak, that is not the symptoms of a country that lacks prestige.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, how, in view of all that, do you explain the increasing toughness and belligerence of the Soviet Union in the world today?
Well, they're no tougher than they've been since the war. Since the end of the war, they're always tough, and sometimes they say hello to you in the corridors, and sometimes they don't. That depends on the mood, but they're always tough. And they're always looking for opportunities. They're always pushing out and pressing out. But to say that the developments in the Congo have any relationship with American prestige is, I think, the most far-fetched thing you can possibly imagine. The developments in the Congo are brought about by entirely different circumstances.
Mr. White.
Mr. Ambassador, you probably know Mr. Khrushchev better than any other American, having traveled with him when he was last here. I'd like to ask you several very short questions about him. Why is he coming here? What's he going to try to accomplish? How's he going to conduct himself?
Well, you're asking me to engage in prophecy. I would say this in reply, that with communists, you shouldn't take what they say or do at face value. I've established that to my own satisfaction many times over the last 7.5 years. There's always a hidden meaning. You certainly got to be prepared for his coming here for the purpose of making propaganda. And if that is his purpose, then it need worry us not at all, because we can use this session of the General Assembly to reveal the fallaciousness and the speciousness of his propaganda. We've done it many times. And we can use this assembly to show some of the truths about the disarmament question, about the fact that disarmament cannot be dealt with simply by slogans the way he would do, but that there has to be consideration of the safety of non-aggressive countries like ours, and the true disarmament has to be accompanied by inspection and control. So if that's what he's coming over here for, that's one of the things we ought to get ready to do. Now, Mr. Wadsworth, last night, our representative, my successor at the UN, did an extremely brilliant thing when he caught the Soviet representative completely off balance, got this special session of the General Assembly, and has unmasked before the whole world the highly improper conduct of the Soviet Union in seeking to penetrate and subvert and take over the Congo in defiance of the United Nations resolutions. Now, that has put them on the defensive, and that is the kind of thing that I have in mind that we should be ready to do when the occasion calls for it, when Mr. Khrushchev gets here.
Mr. Ambassador, what's so all-fired important now about this particular moment in the United Nations? Why is he coming now? Why is he bringing his pack of these Castro and this kind of person with him? Why now?
Well, this is the opening, and this is, they have the so-called general debate every year. The first 10 days begins on the 22nd, I think it is. And they always have 10 days, and it's chiefs of state and foreign ministers come, and it's a time for anybody who wants to come and get up onto the world stage and try to influence world opinion to try to do so. But it's an open forum, and if you have the brains and the wits and the facts and the truth on your side, you don't need to worry.
Mr. Ambassador, may I ask one more question in this connection? These new countries coming into the UN, is there any danger that we will begin losing these elections? Is there any danger of the communists actually taking over the leadership in the UN?
I can't conceive of it. As long as our aspirations harmonize with the general aspirations of mankind, which they have always done, I'm sure we will always, the majority will always be on the side of the United States. And I can't conceive of the time ever coming when our aspirations don't. Because as Abraham Lincoln said of the Declaration of Independence, it gave hope not only to the American people, but for all humanity, for all future time. As long as we're animated by American ideals, we don't need to worry about new countries coming in.
Miss Frederick.
Mr. Ambassador, I'm sure there's no question in the world about your high regard for the United Nations. And serving there as long as you did, you understood completely the role of the United States as the host of this organization. Now, I would like to ask you if you feel that it is in the spirit of our position as host and also in keeping with our dignity as the host of the United Nations that we place any restrictions on the heads of any delegations coming to the United Nations, especially if they are also chiefs of government.
I presume you refer to Mr. Khrushchev, and unless you say that you don't, why, that's what I'll assume.
Yes, you may assume that.
Well, now, what I can't understand is why Mr. Khrushchev would want to be treated differently from the routine that is applied to the heads of the Soviet delegations. Mr. Khrushchev broke up the summit meeting. Mr. Khrushchev insulted President Eisenhower. Mr. Khrushchev withdrew the invitation to President Eisenhower to visit the Soviet Union. Mr. Khrushchev made it perfectly clear that he didn't like the United States government, that he didn't want to be friendly with the United States government. Therefore, why should we treat him like a bosom friend? I haven't finished quite yet. What I can't understand is that people in this country and at the United Nations, and I won't mention any names, should solemnly wag their heads because we're treating Mr. Khrushchev like the head of the Soviet delegation. That's what he is. He is the head of the Soviet delegation. Why treat him like a bosom friend when he's made it clear he doesn't want to be treated by one? This is typical of communist tactics. When they've done something wrong, they immediately accuse you of doing something wrong. It's the old Tammany motto, the old Tammany boss who said, claim everything, concede nothing, and when defeated, allege fraud. Now, that's how the communists run their affairs, and I'm amazed that so many people get taken in by it. That's my answer to you. I maybe you won't agree with it, but that's what I feel about it.
Well, I'm not expressing my own views, as you know. By our questions. But isn't there a possibility here of confusing our role as having relations, a certain kind of relations with these delegations, and our role as host to the United Nations? Now, if the United Nations is going to continue to attract heads of government and other delegations who are so unpleasant to us and whom we dislike so much, wouldn't it be better for the United Nations to move out and go to some country where they would have free access to the UN?
I'm not saying, and I have not said, not insinuated, that we should not live up to the headquarters agreement. And we are living up to the headquarters agreement. And when we make it possible for Mr. Khrushchev to visit all the diplomats in New York and go to the United Nations, and he can go to the theater, he can go to the bank, he can go to the department store, he can go to the hospital, he can do all those things. I don't know why it's necessary to give him a great big trip around the United States when we gave him one last year, and when he's just withdrawn the invitation to President Eisenhower to do the same thing in Russia. I can't understand that reasoning. We're living up to the headquarters agreement.
If by some miraculous chance he were coming here with a serious motive, of course we don't believe he is, but if he should be coming here with a serious motive, you know him well enough to know how he reacts. How do you think that this motive might be affected by coming here and realizing that he's going to be brought in to appear at the East River where no other ship has docked for a long time, that he's going to be restricted and treated the way he is?
You think that's good, tough action of the kind that he understands well and has meted out to many others and which he knows inspires respect in many people?
Mr. Lindley.
Senator
Lodge. You take it sentimentally, I can assure you.
Have you advised the United States government to put the restrictions on
him? I'm not advising the United States government. I'm not in the United States government. I'm a citizen and a taxpayer and a candidate for public office, and I'm not advising the United States government. I just watch the United States government at work.
Well, press reports say that you have been advised.
Oh, well, the press is usually right, of course, but romance a little bit.
Mr. Lindley.
Well, Candidate Lodge, then, you have said, and I refer particularly to a speech you made in Columbus, Ohio on September 12th, that through our diplomacy, we must win and hold the initiative. Hmm. Now, a great many people have said that for about 14 years since the Cold War started, and we heard a great deal about it in 1952 from General Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles, and I think yourself, among many other Republicans.
Now, in effect, aren't you conceding that we have not succeeded in 8 years in winning and holding the initiative?
Not at all, Mr. Lindley, not at all. A man never does a perfect job. There's always room for improvement. We have had many very successful initiatives. The President's Atoms for Peace program, the President's Open Sky plan, which was a wonderfully successful thing, our initiative on inspection, United Nations inspection over the Arctic, our initiative in Lebanon, the initiative creating the United Nations Emergency Force, the initiative in the Congo, the most recent one. I could find a great many others. We've used the initiative all the time. I think the world is getting closer, smaller and smaller, and as it gets smaller, you've got to have more initiative and you've got to have quicker and quicker machinery.
But
I think what we've done has been adequate. But I think we can take honest pride in it, as Governor Stevenson said in this article in the New York Times magazine today.
But overall, do you think we have the initiative in the eyes of the world?
I think, broadly speaking, the Soviet Union is reacting to us all the time. I think we're the constant preoccupation to them. I think tactically we have the initiative in the United Nations a great part of the time. I do.
In answer to a question from Mr. Spivak, you said we had more prestige than any other nation. Relative to the Soviet Union, do you think we have as much prestige and as much influence in the world as we had 8 years ago?
Well, now, let me just point to the U2 case. Now, you might say that if ever there was a case where we didn't have the law on our side, it was the U2 case. And yet, when the Soviet Union proceeded against us in the Security Council on the U2 case, they got the most dreadful defeat. Now, does that show that the Soviet Union has got more prestige than we have when they had a case where you might say that they had us in the wrong?
Yes.
To me, that answers your question,
Mr.
Hodge,
but since 8 years ago, they've had their great rocket development.
Yeah, but this was last spring.
Yes, I know.
This was in May.
Yes, I know.
Well, that doesn't show their prestige is very high.
Well,
compared to us.
But you have cited other cases in the United Nations when it seems to me, you correct me if I'm wrong, your main effort was to avoid defeat. You accepted very watered-down resolutions. That may be a tribute to your parliamentary skill.
You'd do me a favor if you'd mention one,
the treatment of the RB-47. They didn't accept your version of it, to which I believed, of course,
I think you're misinformed. The resolution which we sponsored was a resolution for an impartial investigation,
yes, right,
and which both the Afro-Asian members of the Council voted for, which the Soviets then vetoed,
yes.
And when they vetoed a resolution for an impartial investigation, they said to the world, we were lying, we were not telling the truth, this plane was not over the Soviet Union, it was the most complete justification for our cause you could possibly have. There was no watering down there.
Mr. Spivak.
Ambassador Lodge, a great many American observers and some of our leading observers believe that so far, we've been losing this Cold War. I take it you think we're winning it.
I didn't say we were winning it. I said that our prestige was good because in the UN, where you can measure prestige, we do not get defeated. I pointed to what Governor Stevenson said in the New York Times today about our United States having done so much of which we could be proud. There's a very prominent Democrat. I pointed to Senator Mansfield of Montana, what he said about Secretary Hooter and me in connection with Africa. Bipartisan support like that doesn't indicate that in this country people think we've lost prestige or that abroad we have.
Well, where do you think we stand in the Cold War? You have said that we will win the Cold War by ending it.
I hope we can, yes.
You hope we can?
I certainly do.
Where do you think we stand today in the Cold War?
We're on
the defensive in
Berlin. Well, I don't know. Now, you're making a speech, Mr. Spivak,
which
have a right to do, but I thought you were supposed to ask me questions.
Well, this is the question. Where are we winning it? Since we are on the defensive in Cuba and in Berlin,
we aren't on the defensive in Berlin any more than they are. And in Cuba, when they brought their complaint against us into the United Nations, we got the votes to send it to the Organization of American States, which is the beginning of the solution to that problem, is by having the other Latin American countries do it. You certainly wouldn't have thought it right, I shouldn't think, if Secretary Herder had been mousetrapped into making another Hungary out of Cuba, in which the United States took the role in Cuba that the Soviet Union did in Hungary. I don't think you would have liked that. At the same time, it would be obviously intolerable for Cuba to become an active imperialist communist base, and the nations of the American hemisphere won't allow that. But there's got to be some patience as well as some firmness. And as Walter Lippmann said, I think nothing becomes a strong nation so much as restraint and patience.
Well, do you think then that our position in Berlin and in Cuba and in Korea and in Japan is as good as it was 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
I think in South America, in many ways, we have many fewer of these dictators. I think that's a good sign. I think the sentiment for us in Japan is friendly. I think the situation in Korea is at least nobody's getting killed there. There's that to be said for it. I think in Berlin, we're just where we stood. We're going to keep our word. I personally think that we ought to be prepared to see the Berlin thing brought up at the General Assembly, and I personally would like to see the United Nations brought into Berlin, supplementary to what's there already, let's say by some such device as having United Nations guards at the checkpoint, something like that. I'm not saying there isn't a chance to make a little... negotiating on Berlin, but basically there's our honor has been pledged. If we go back on our word on Berlin, we destroy every commitment we've made all over the world. Now, that's not a criticism of us. That we ought to be praised for keeping our word. We're not on the defensive in Berlin any more than the communists are.
Mr. White.
Mr. Ambassador, I'd like to bring you back to the immediate campaign, perhaps a projection of it, though. Other than presiding over the Senate, the job of the vice presidency is just about whatever the president wants to make it. If you and Mr. Nixon are elected, what kind of responsibilities do you anticipate carrying out for the president?
Well, Mr. Nixon announced the day after we were nominated in Chicago that if elected, he would give the next vice president the job of directing all the non-military aspects of the world struggle. And, of course, that would be a tremendous job and would keep any vice president extremely busy.
Staying in the context of the campaign, what is your position on the religious issue?
I do not want anybody to vote for me on a religious ground. I refuse to accept the proposition that my three Catholic grandchildren, or my two Episcopalian grandchildren for that matter, or anybody's children or grandchildren, are debarred from becoming president because of religion or race. Communism is against all Christianity. Communism is against Judaism as far as that goes. People who believe in God should stand together. The question has no place whatever in this campaign, even to bring it up, even for a journalist to bring it up. Violates the spirit of the Constitution, and that's what I think about the religious question.
We have about 3 minutes. Ms. Frederick.
One brief question about Mr. K, and then another, if I may. If Mr. Khrushchev asks for a private talk with President Eisenhower, do you think the president should agree?
Well, I would certainly look at that with a very different eye if Mr. Khrushchev had released Lieutenant Olmsted and Lieutenant McCone, whom he is now illegally detaining in an absolutely outrageous manner. Those two officers ought to be released. And that would be my initial reaction to that question.
So the president should not...
I didn't say that. I said that would be my initial reaction to that question.
And one other question. You have spoken about the United States being willing to discuss the U-2 case and the other cases in the United Nations. Why is not the United States willing to discuss the question of Red China in the United Nations?
We think that Red China should be kept out of the United Nations because it is in flagrant violation of every single thing that the United Nations stands for, and to admit Red China would be to stultify the United Nations. When, as and if the time comes that Red China's behavior changes,
That'll be the time to look at the question of discussing it.
Mr. Lindley.
You've said that the communist leaders, and I quote, have contempt for our lack of mastery of what they call the art of revolution.
Mm.
Do you think we should master the art of revolution, and where should we practice it?
I think we should move ahead on this whole business of the non-military aspects of the world struggle.
Right.
I think that we've done well, but I think with the world getting tighter all the time and smaller all the time, we've got to step up our whole approach on the non-military aspects.
Well, is this a way of advocating revolution promoted by us on the other side of the Iron Curtain?
No.
Is this a reversion to rollback and liberation?
No, it certainly is not. And it is not trying to outdo the communists at their own game. But it is an attempt to make the people of the world understand that we believe the American Revolution holds promise for them, and to talk about the promise of the American Revolution and not about the menace of the Communist Revolution.
When you, if you do take charge of all the non-military aspects of the world struggle on behalf of the United States, what new instruments would you want? What new agencies that you don't have now?
Well, I'd want to have an office. I'd want to have an office which contained a staff which would pull together all the non-military aspects of foreign policy, that is, economic aid, strategy, tactics at the UN, exchanges, ICA, loans and grants, USIA, all these various things.
Mr. Ambassador...
And a group to try to think constantly in short range and long range about getting the initiative.
I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you very much, Ambassador Lodge, for being with us.